Zoom.gov. Today is Tuesday, February 16th, 2021. It is 1 p.m. and we are ready for our first case. But before we get started, just a few logistical items. First of all, we want to thank both of you for joining us virtually. We definitely would have preferred to have had this in person, but obviously because of the current pandemic and the Chief Justice's orders, we are holding our hearings at this time virtually. This is being recorded. No other recordings, either by audio or video, are permitted unless you ask permission beforehand. There is a stop clock in the screen, so be sure to watch that in terms of your time. And so our first case for today is case number A20-1122, State of Minnesota, ex rel. Gundel, Nygaard, Gilo, and if I'm mispronouncing any of these names, my apologies, versus Paul Schnell, Commissioner of Corrections. Attorney for the petitioner, for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. When you begin, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. And if we do have, because we are doing this virtually, if there are any technical issues that we run into, we will certainly accommodate the parties at that time to make sure that everybody has sufficient time for their oral arguments and to listen to them and respond to all of them. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Gundel Gilo. Today, we're asking this court to reverse the Department of Corrections' decision to revoke Mr. Gilo's community-based supervision. There's two issues that we're presenting here today, and the first is a threshold question about whether there's even a constitutionally protected liberty interest in remaining in the community before having that release revoked to prison. And then the second issue is really more of an examination of what the conditions of his release say, and under the undisputed facts of this case, whether those facts show that Mr. Gilo violated those conditions of his release. Because this case presents a real significant question about whether the DOC even needs to have revocation hearings, I'd like to start with the liberty question first. The liberty question is most critical because it determines the rights of parolees or releasees, whatever we call them. If there is no protected liberty interest, then the DOC is not required to have a hearing before reincarcerating a person in a Minnesota State Correctional Facility for years.
Your Honor, Mr. Wendell, we all acknowledge that the Supreme Court has indicated in a case that phase one is not a protected liberty. And I think it's important if we're going to examine phase two or phase three, that we consider what each of these phases entails. And if you were aware of phase one, but my problem in reading the district court order is phase one talks about how the individual that's involved in the programming will remain institutionalized. Yet my awareness of the provisions are such that the individual not only is at a boot camp facility, but works out, has psychological evals, engages in community opportunities, doing some restorative justice. To me, that says at phase one, he's not in the institution to which he or she was initially sentenced to. So in other words, if you were at Stillwater, you might end up in Togo, Minnesota, which we know is way up north in the middle of the woods. If you were at Stillwater, you also may end up at Willow River. Or if you're a female, you're going to end up at Shakopee, which is our only state female facility. So I want you to tell me why phase one is so different than phase two.
It's phase two and phase three are outside the four walls of the prison. And they live in the community.
Phase one and phase two are both, there is activity in phase one, is there not, that's outside of the walls?
No, Your Honor.
Where does the restorative? I'm sorry.
Phase one takes place inside the prison. They are not released by any technical or imaginative or literal definition.
I think you misunderstood my question. if an individual first starts serving their sentence at St. Cloud, I think I said Stillwater before, that isn't the facility that this program is at. The facility could be at Togo, which clearly is not the same as perhaps Stillwater or St. Cloud. So what I'm trying to say is explain those differences to us, because they're not in the facility they start at.
Your Honor, I respectfully, I disagree with your premise. I mean, they've stopped sending people to those other prisons. I mean, it's not a matter of this court record. I know that traditionally people have been sent to Moose Lake or Togo, or even some of the women used to have CIP take place at Togo. Those places are prisons as much as St. Cloud or Stillwater. They hold CIP now in Shakopee. The DOC is free to do phase one of CIP at any prison. There's no rules prohibiting them from doing it anywhere.
So your distinction then is first and foremost that they're no longer behind the prison walls, whatever that facility may be.
Yeah, the significant distinction is they transition from a status of incarcerated person in any of the state correctional facilities during phase one. Phase two is a transition to a community-based setting. They don't have a prison case manager anymore. They have an agent. They aren't subject to the rules of prison discipline. They are subject to the rules of their supervised release, those conditions that they receive when they leave the confines of whatever institution they are leaving.
And I mean, during this case of time, the initial prison sentence remains over that individual's head, if you will, in the event of a violation, right?
That's correct.
Initial sentence is there.
The sentence does not change. It is an early release at a time before their mandatory release date identified and discussed more in depth in Carrillo.
And the early release will occur if, in fact, they complete phase one, phase two, and phase three.
If and only if they complete phase one, they are released to complete phases two and three in the community. I don't think the state and I, or I don't think the commissioner and I disagree that phases two and three are in the community. Phases two and three are undeniably in the community.
Well, I don't disagree with that either. What I'm trying to get at is I'm trying to understand the complexity of how this, if a person is in phase two, and there is something, let's just, not your client in particular, but there's something egregious that happens, that person does go back to prison, the initial site, and finishes his or her prison term as ordered, with, of course, the credit for the time in phase one. Is that right? I want to make sure I'm following this correctly.
Yeah, I mean, they don't necessarily go back to the same prison, but yeah, they go back to prison and the hearing officer makes the decision to revoke their CIP and they have to serve out the balance of the term of imprisonment that the inmate otherwise would have had to serve, but
so
for their participation.
What have they lost? Because their time accrual would continue.
The same thing that any parolee or person serving on supervised release would lose. The right to stay in the community subject to their compliance with the conditions of release.
My next question then, Mr. Whitehall, is if I am in phase two and my entire sentence has expired, or I'm in phase three and my entire sentence has run, I'm done then, correct? I don't have to still continue until phase three is done. I'm out, right?
There is a huge incentive to completing phase, yes, there's a huge incentive to completing phase two and phase three in the community, because
even if
it's forgiven.
Even if my jail sentence has expired, I've served out my 15 months, and here I am, I'm still in phase two, I'm out. I'm not required to continue with phase three, am I?
I don't know. I mean, the way DOC administers phases two and three is kind of this seamless thing where they spend a year on intensive supervision and then the DOC transfers the person to regular supervised release. And then that person is not subject to, I think I lost Judge Werke. Oh, you're back.
I was trying to mute, I'm sorry.
So the consequences after completing phases two and three in the community change to the consequences only in duration. to a person on regular supervised release or intensive supervised release in the community. So the distinction in the duration of the consequence is a thing, but the nature of the consequence is no different. It's the difference between being in the community subject to the same exact conditions as anybody else on community release. A person on intensive supervised release, ISR, is subject to the same conditions and actually the same agents and the same expectations as a person on ISR. And the DOC just decides who's on ISR and who's not after a mandatory release date. The conditions are the same. The experiences are exactly the same because Morrissey identifies that it is the nature of the liberty interest that defines whether there's a constitutionally protected liberty interest. Judge Reyes, I'm sorry if you saw you unmuted.
Sure. Thank you. So I want to focus on what's in the record and you raised Morrissey, which is actually an issue that I wanted to touch upon. But before I get to that, you had mentioned there are a number of ways that based on the record that is before us, which is what we're limited to, why phase two is different than phase one. And you had mentioned that they're not within the four walls of the prison. I didn't quite catch everything, but you had mentioned that they also report to different agents or their reporting is different. And
no, I mean, if you take a person who's not on CIP, but otherwise ISR, intensive supervised release, it's a form of strict supervision in the community. A person on CIP and a person on ISR, there's no difference. The conditions are the same. It's the same DOC agents divided by region. It's identical. The only difference is the consequence. A person on ISR could be revoked for a determinate number of days, like 90 days or 6 months, as a consequence proportional to the severity of the violation. A CIP participant's revocation is non-negotiable. It is, if they are revoked, they serve the balance of the term of imprisonment that they would have saved by completing the CIP program. So the way CIP works, if you have 13 to 48 months remaining on your term of imprisonment, if you have up to 48 months left, you can't have more time left, you get out early after completing phase one of the boot camp. And then if you complete a year on intensive supervision, the DOC basically forgives that term of imprisonment and you transition to supervised release. The thing is, you remain in the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections for the remainder of the sentence. Your expiration date never changes. The nature of the consequence can change for violating if you transition from CIP supervision to traditional supervision, but that's only in duration. The nature of the consequence is exactly the same. It's you go sit in prison until you get out.
Okay, so a couple quick questions. So first, you would agree that phase one, you don't have a liberty interest based on Hines, correct?
I have no problem with Hines. Hines is okay. Exactly right.
Okay, so for phase two, what is the, looking at Morrissey, that focuses on the liberty interest rather than the type of program that it is, what is the liberty interest or interests that a phase two participant would potentially lose?
Mr. Hines is living at a private residence with a landlord who he paid rent to. Mr. Hines is, or not Hines, I'm sorry, Mr. Gilo is living at a private residence. He had a landlord. He was free to have his friend, Mr. Connor, who caused all of these problems, come live with him. His son was living with him. Mr. Gilo and his son were living in the second story of this house together. He's free to go to work. All he has to do is comply with the house arrest restrictions that anyone on supervision, on intensive supervision, has to comply with. And he has to report to his agent and otherwise remain compliant with the conditions that are imposed on him when he leaves the prison. So, I mean, he can do anything. He can drive a car. He can have a job. He can go on vacation. He can go camping or fishing or enjoy all the things that we miss doing during the winter and
now,
the pandemic.
Those things that you're alluding to, I just want to make sure we have the totality of the record. The record does include the DOC policy that outlines all of these expansive abilities he has in phase two to go on vacation and so on, as you said. Is that part of the record?
No, it's not expressly. Judge Reyes, we didn't.
Judge Reyes did bring up the question, what's before us as far as the DOC policy record? And I'm trying to follow up on what he's saying. If that's not before us, if we don't have the established policy, then how do we know what violations there may have been as far as entitlement?
Judge Werke, the only thing Mr. Gilo is not allowed to do is what's prohibited in his conditions.
Me that he's allowed to go on vacation, and I'm looking for the verification of that in the record. Where can he go on vacation? Where can he go to work? Where is this all explicitly laid out in terms of what he can or cannot do?
The condition, one of his conditions is that he has to follow his agent's instructions. He can ask his agent permission to do something, and if the agent says no, he can't do it. The agent says yes, he can do it.
So then when you were just basically throwing out a laundry list of what he can do by saying vacation, that's not something that's in there that the person that's out of the prison setting can go on a vacation. We don't know that, do we?
We do, because he can do anything that the conditions permit him to do. He is a free person, subject only to the conditions of his release. And the things that he is free to do are exactly the things that you and I are able to do and enjoy with the express restrictions of his conditions. That's what's part of the record. So I'm asking the court
is there anything in the record that explicitly says, and I'm talking about DOC policy, that his liberties are in fact reinstated, but for whatever the restrictions may have been? I'm just looking for something in the record that can guide us one way or the other.
Yeah, I would point, Your Honor, to the conditions of his release. It's one of the state's exhibits attached to the return and the habeas proceedings, identifying exactly what he can't do. And those are his conditions of release. There's like, I think, 7 standard conditions. It used to be 13, now it's fewer. And then there's a laundry list of special conditions that he is required to comply with. Your Honor, I see that my time is up. I ask this court to find that a liberty interest applies to people in phase 2 of CIP.
Thank you very much. Mr. Whittle, you'll also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We now have 15 minutes that we will set for counsel for respondent. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, everyone. May it please the court. Kevin Jonasson representing respondent Paul Schnell. There is no protected liberty interest in phase 2 of the CIP program, the CIP. It's not really true that once he's in phase 2, he can do anything that the conditions do not allow. There is a CIP rule packet that is part of the record that goes through and lays forth all of the expectations of what someone can expect on phase 2.
Mr. Johansson, isn't he outside of the walls of the prison?
Yes, I'll grant that he's outside the walls of the prison, but I don't think that can be the only analysis when we're looking at what entails a protected liberty interest.
What do we look at, though? Don't we look at the interest, and don't we look at Morrissey, the U.S. Supreme Court case? How is this any different than somebody who is on parole, who is subject to conditions as well, but is no longer in prison? And Mr. Whittle conceded that a phase 1 participant still is within prison and does not have any protected liberty interest. So the issue is whether in phase 2, because you're outside the walls and no longer in prison and could have your liberty, your freedom to live where you want, to work where you want, to get a job, that you could have those liberties revoked. Why isn't that the same type of liberty interest that Morrissey requires due process protections for?
Well, first, I want to start by saying that the court has gotten away from Morrissey a little bit. And in Sandin versus O'Connor, rather than talking about a grievous loss, they talk about an atypical significant hardship, which means whether the conditions represent a dramatic departure from the basic conditions of an offender's sentence. The basic conditions of an offender's sentence in Minnesota is that you serve 2/3 of your sentence. Mr. Gilo had not served 2/3 of his sentence when he was in community. Being revoked and reincarnated, therefore, does not represent a dramatic departure from the conditions of his sentence, because the basic condition is that you serve 2/3. Being told to serve your 2/3 is not a dramatic departure from that. And I think Morrissey is different also, because the U.S. Supreme Court when they talked about the type of parole at issue, I think it's fairly clear that they're talking about the determinant sentencing scheme that Minnesota has. They start their analysis by noting that some states have discretionary parole. Some states have codified their parole. Well, Minnesota is one of the states that has codified their parole. You serve your two-thirds at least, and then you have up to one-third in the community.
But Morrissey said, Morrissey highlighted that you can have two different types of situations, but Morrissey never explicitly said that we need to treat those two differently.
No, I don't think it's explicit, but I think that when you go towards what the court was getting at, I think that what they were getting at when they made their analysis and their determination in that case is far more akin to what the Minnesota Supreme Court talked about in Carrillo, which the court in Hines said CIP is not like. It is not like supervised release.
Well, but see, with Hines, though, Hines only dealt with the issue of a phase one participant. The issue before us in that case was never a phase two or a phase three. So that case only applies to a phase one participant.
Well, it is true that Mr. Hines was in phase one, but the court never specifically qualified that it only applies to phase one.
We have to look at the holding in light of the particular facts in that case. So any discussion of what liberty interest to CIP participants in general, whether phase one, phase two, or three, that would just be Ditka. That is not part of our holding. The only part that is a holding is applies to what a phase one participant, because those were the only facts before us in that case.
And if that is the case, and it's only Ditka, then we can look to what the court found in that case about the CIP and whether or not that remains true while on phase two. It's still discretionary. It's still a discretionary program. It's still a rehabilitative program, Your Honor, which, the Court of Appeals has said in the past, rehabilitative programs do not come with it a protected liberty interest. And Guth versus Fabian, they noted that special programming and work release, when you are outside the walls of the prison for some amount of time at least, does not come with it a protected liberty interest.
But that went beyond just the whether it's discretionary or rehabilitative. And for that matter, Morrissey, when we look at parole, and parole is recognized in Minnesota as something that does contain a protected liberty interest, those are discretionary and can be discretionary and certainly are rehabilitative programs as well, because you have to report back to your probation officer. You have strict conditions that you need to follow. If you don't follow those conditions, you can have that revoked. I'm struggling to understand how that's any different than what we have with a CIP phase two. In contrast to phase one, which I think is pretty clear, there's not that interest because you're still in prison at that point. You are still behind bars.
Well, and I think one of the differences is that when you're in CIP in phase two, the rules that come with phase two are significantly different than your traditional parole. I mean, we're talking about up to 4 hours of free time, mandatory exercise time. During the first level of phase two, if you're not attending support group, seeking employment or working or going to school, doing community service, and all of those that list of things you have to be doing, you have up to 4 hours of free time. So it's not as if you can just go on vacation. I think that's one thing that distinguishes it. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, sorry. And this is good. I like this dialogue. But to the point that your opposing counsel raised, I do want to make clear, do you agree with him that there is a difference between phase one and phase two in terms of whether the person is incarcerated or is free to live where they want to live outside of the prison?
I agree with the fact that they're no longer incarcerated, sure.
Okay. I want to ask a question about that because I can't help thinking my district court friends will wonder if someone is sentenced to house arrest and they're not behind walls, does that mean that they have a greater liberty interest? That's an aside, but it's important here because we're talking about that being something very important to the appellant's concept of no walls, no perimeters, and having a protected interest.
Well, and I think that goes back to the point I made. I don't think that the analysis is simply whether you're outside the prison walls, because if that were the case, I mean, we could have special furloughs granted where you would have a due process right before your furlough was revoked. If you had a 2 or 3 day furlough, you violate whatever conditions are attached to that on day one, and then you have a hearing attached. I mean, I just can't be simply whether you're outside the prison walls. I think that
I agree with you there, and I think that's a good distinction, but a work release is something that's temporary. You still are subject to remaining in prison. You still have to return to prison. But in phase two, if you comply with all the conditions that are set out, you don't have to go back to prison, and you may never go back to prison if you actually comply with all the conditions. I think one of the differences here is, as the Supreme Court noted in Greenholz, is there's a difference between losing what somebody has and not getting what one wants. In phase one, there's that expectation of hopefully being able to get out of jail, get out of jail free card. But phase two, you are actually out of jail. And wouldn't you agree that's an indeterminate? You're outside of jail indeterminately, subject to complying with your conditions of CIP, right?
Right. And I think that, you know, one of the distinctions in from the court in Hines, I mean, also remains true in issues of phase two, that if you're revoked, what you're losing is the, you know, entitlement of being released in the community earlier than was expected. And that's why I think that we really have to look at this in terms of Sandin versus Honor, which is, you know, is this a dramatic departure from what could be expected from an inmate who has not served 2/3 of his sentence yet? It's not. To be reincarcerated before your 2/3 expires is not atypical, because the statute lays forth that you have to serve a minimum term of 2/3. The CIP is special in that regard, and it says if you can meet all of our strict qualifications, if you can follow our strict rules, then you can be out for longer than your 2/3.
How is that different than a parolee? Because isn't a parolee subject to strict conditions as well that they need to follow?
I think that the conditions are stricter in the CIP for sure, and the rules are stricter.
But then you're just talking a matter of degree, but you're still subject to conditions, and the conditions can vary from person to person. One person might have more strict conditions based on the crimes that they committed, based on the person that they are, based on their history. But in either setting, in either situation, they're still subject to conditions, correct? Strict conditions.
They are subject to conditions regardless. That's correct. But I know I'm just maybe coming back to this too often, but it you know, what is typical in Minnesota is to serve your 2/3. And being out on a special discretionary early release program, being found to have violated the conditions of which, and being told that you have to now go back and serve the remainder of your 2/3, when the expectation all along is that you serve your 2/3, that's not an atypical and significant hardship in terms of Sandin.
How is that different than a parolee? Couldn't the parolee have their parole revoked and go back to prison as well?
Yes, and how it's different from a parolee is that when they're revoked, they've already served their 2/3 expectation. Okay, so when they have their expectation that they will serve a minimum of 2/3. If they, a standard release offender is in the community during their 1/3, they've already got to the point where their expected 2/3 has expired, they're in the community, and Carrillo has said that that is where the liberty interest attaches. And that's where it's different, I think. And I think I would be remiss if I didn't note that for all of our discussion on the liberty interest, I don't even know that it's necessary to get to in this case, because there's simply not an allegation that the hearing that Mr. Gilo was afforded somehow didn't comply with due process requirements set forth in Morrison.
Well, let's assume for the sake of argument that the allegations were broad enough, because he did argue that his removal was erroneous and he wanted to have a hearing on whether or not he could be removed based on the conduct of a third party. Two of the conditions that he had been revoked on were considered material. If we assume for the sake of argument that those two were not material violations that he had received notice for beforehand, wouldn't we have to reverse and remand to the hearing officer to determine whether the hearing officer what punishment would have occurred for the cell phone violation?
I don't think that's necessarily the case, Your Honor. I think because the cell phone violation, the cell phone violation alone is enough to sustain the revocation under a clear abuse discretion standard. I think that if it was unclear in an interpretation of what the hearing officer would have done, I guess, if the first two, the firearms and the alcohol prohibition, could not be sustained, if it was unclear what the result would be then I guess I would say that remand would be the appropriate remedy.
Okay, because, and that makes sense, because under Minnesota Rule 2940.3700, that does allow for a number of actions that the hearing officer could take, could revoke the phase two, or could modify it, or could just keep it going as it is. But we don't know what the hearing officer would do if it was only the one violation that remained, right?
Well, I mean, I will note that the hearing officer certainly focused on those two violations, but when you listen to the end of the hearing, he does find that he violated all three, and the hearing officer says broadly that I find these violations to be material. And I guess if there's no further questions, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johansson. Mr. Whittall, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. And, you know, I feel like I might be answering Judge Werke's question earlier with a little bit more specificity on the difference between someone who's on phase one and phase two as far as liberty interests. I want to direct the court's attention to page 395 of Heilman v. Courtney that says that defining what phase two is, because they are released from prison, they have certain freedoms, including social time, visitor privileges, the ability to find work, receive an education, and worship in the community. These freedoms, even if burdened with Department of Corrections pre-approval requirements, are not available to phase two participants before they are released from prison from confinement. So if we're looking for something from the record, I think published Supreme Court discussion on what the difference is between what a phase one and phase two participant gets to enjoy is probably persuasive on the question of what the nature of the liberty interest is at stake. I also want to highlight that these cases that the department is relying on, Sandin, Guth, Hines, which I think this court has recognized, none of these talk about petitioners seeking relief from revocation from the community. Sandin v. Connor is a discussion about the size of the box that a person is held in within the prison. It's a case about what liberty interest there is among prisoners who are placed in disciplinary confinement within the institution. It is not a discussion about what the liberty interest is or the nature of the liberty interest for an individual in the community. The same is true of Guth. And Hines, too, is a person complaining about being able to participate in a prison-based program. I think there is a significant difference not only in the dichotomy between a person who's in the community and within the institution, but also a pretty bright line between the nature of the liberty interests at stake in all of these cases cited by the state in support of their argument that there's no liberty interest, because not a single one of those cases discusses the liberty interest of an individual who is released to the community subject to conditions. Because that is the distinction recognized in Morrissey. That's still good law. That's never been challenged. In fact, Sandin, read it closely, it actually criticizes other decisions extending Morrissey to liberty interests like the one presented by Connor and Sandy V. Connor about the mandatory nature of the rules of the commissioner of corrections in each of those cases within the institution in managing a population within the walls of the prison. That's what Sandin v. Connor is about. Sandin v. Connor has nothing to do about the nature of the liberty interest at stake when an individual living free subject to conditions in the community is facing revocation back to the institution.
Also, could you respond to respondent's point that the hearing afforded your client complied with due process?
It does not comply with due process if it doesn't satisfy the minimum requirements of due process.
Notice and an opportunity to be heard.
Notice requires being told what your conditions are when you're released from the institution, which binds the Department of Corrections on their ability to revoke an individual for conduct not contemplated in the conditions that are explained to that individual when they leave the prison. Mr. Gilo was told
that he had to share his cell phone.
There is a search condition that requires him to submit to unannounced searches. We didn't challenge that.
Didn't it refer to cell phones specifically?
It probably does. Okay. I don't have it in front of me.
And did he follow that?
The hearing officer found that he did not.
Well, is that fact disputed?
We've not challenged that condition because the hearing officer did not find it material.
Well, he didn't say it was not material.
The hearing officer only revoked because of the material violations, and the hearing officer did not revoke because of the immaterial violations. Whether the hearing officer can revoke for immaterial violations is something that's reserved for the hearing officer to decide at their discretion. And if this court reverses the violations for the other two, I think it's still up to the DOC whether they would have revoked if only one violation remained. And I, under my reading of the statute, they would not. But that's, again, up to the hearing officer's sound discretion.
But you don't contest that he violated the cell phone provision, the provision of his conditions of release of searches of his cell phones, correct?
We denied that violation. We disputed it. We contested it, and the hearing officer found violation. So I don't want to be disrespectful to the hearing officer's findings on that. He found it. He exercised his discretion. He applied the facts of the case. We don't agree, but I'm not going to concede that violation. The hearing officer found violation. That's part of the record.
Well, let me rephrase it. You're not challenging that on appeal. You're just challenging the two other material violations, correct?
We are only challenging the two violations that form the basis of the hearing officer's decision to revoke. And that we actually explained that in detail in the administrative appeal, why we were not challenging the third violation and reserved the right to challenge the third violation if it was in fact relied upon to revoke them. What's the point of challenging an immaterial violation?
Okay, I understand now. But actually one last question, and since I'm presiding, I will give myself the authority to ask it. Mr. Anson mentioned that in the hearing transcript, which we just received, that at the very end, the hearing officer refers to all three as being material. My understanding was that the hearing officer only referred to two being material.
I share your understanding and refer you to the hearing audio and the hearing officer's written notes that he's constitutionally required to issue after the hearing under Morrissey. The written findings is the last requirement of minimum due process, and those form the basis for the hearing officer's decision. He did not find that the third violation was material, and only the material violations form the basis for mandate. If there is a material violation under the statute, it is a mandatory revocation of the entire CIP release. I don't know if I can say this. Like, they don't revoke for non-material violations of CIP because the consequences are so severe for a non-material violation, they just don't revoke. They revoke material violations and they revoke for violations of the law upon criminal conviction. Those are the mandatory basis to revoke CIP. That's when they do it. If those don't exist, they don't do it.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your oral arguments and your written briefs. Both were very well done. Both were very helpful for us in this case. We'll be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both again. Stay safe and stay warm.